This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by and feed.
All right. Them on Teach your children dreams. Well, right?
Yes.
We hope. I know my child, who's not really a child anymore.
Just the music that they pick is just so on point. So thank you to the team who does that.
CSNY? Yeah.
Yeah.
Crosby, Stills. Love it. When it comes to teaching kids, sometimes they need an assist. And I have to say, my daughter, over the years, has definitely tapped into Khan Academy.
So have I.
So have you.
Yeah.
When you were in business school.
Exactly. I mean, it got me through business school. I'm really excited to have with us Saul Khan, founder and CEO of Khan Academy. He joins us on Zoom from Mountain View, California. Saul, I got to tell you, I promised myself when I finally did get to interview you this many years after business school, I would thank you for the videos that you did about discounted cash flows and interest rates and all the things that I worked on in my personal finance and accounting classes, because it was your voice that helped guide me through business school. And it's interesting because this, Carol, wasn't available when I was an undergraduate. We weren't even talking about YouTube back then. Very pleased to have back with us Saul Khan, founder and CEO of Khan Academy, joining us from Mountain View. Saul, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
You know, take us back to 2008, because it's funny, and thinking about this interview that we're doing right now, you know, we think about online education, the way that it really gained so much attention in the early part of 2020 during lockdowns and when kids were sent home. You had been working on Khan Academy for a dozen years by the time the pandemic hit. Take us back there and where we are now.
Yeah, in some ways, earlier, it all started back actually in 2004 when I was tutoring some cousins remotely when I was in Boston. They were in New Orleans. I started writing software for them. A friend suggested I make videos for them on YouTube. It took on a life of their own. And it was in 2008 that I actually set up this family project as a not-for-profit, a mission-free world-class education for anyone anywhere, and called it Khan Academy. And if we compare that time to where we are now, I think now people actually take it for granted that, of course, on-demand video is going to be really useful for learning. Of course, students should be able to have self-paced practice. Of course, it's not the best use of class time for a teacher to just lecture at students and students to sit passively and listen because students have access to on-demand video. Perhaps it might be a good idea to allow students to learn at their own time and pace. But if you go back to 2008, none of that was mainstream. People thought things like YouTube and maybe the internet generally, for the most part, was a toy or maybe a distraction. But now we realize that it's central to the education. I think the other really good thing that happened is, obviously, when we set out as a not-for-profit, in the name of trying to level the playing field, it's predicated on the idea that everyone eventually will have access to the internet. In 2008, we weren't anywhere close to that. We still aren't at perfection. But in school environments, we've come a long way in the U.S. Globally, there's still a lot more work to be done. And I think the pandemic, one of the silver linings is it helped accelerate a lot of internet and tech adoption, not just in schools, but at home as well.
How do you think the impact it's had on how kids learn or helped supplement, classroom time?
Yeah, well, I think, everything is a double-edged sword. We all know about all of the things on the internet that maybe aren't the most productive things for kids. But in terms of when they are productive on it, whether you're talking about kids in elementary school or middle school, all the way to med students, it's now become pretty mainstream that students are going to vote with their feet. If there's someone who's just going to lecture at them and the students have an option, they won't show up anymore. If you visit most med schools, the actual lecture halls are pretty empty. The med students, who are very diligent students, are usually going to watch the lecture later on at double speed. So I think there's an expectation. Now, some people say, oh, kids these days have less of an attention span. I don't think they have less of an attention span necessarily. It's more that they have more options and they have higher expectations. When we were kids, we're like, okay, we got to sit in the classroom and just pretend to pay attention and look at the clock. And so we're going to play that game. But now you don't have to do that. They have other things. I think they know that if they don't understand something in class, back when we were kids, you'd have to either somehow struggle with a textbook, or if you're lucky enough to have a family member help you or had enough resources to get a tutor. And now we're talking about very few people. Now people know, yeah, I can go to Khan Academy. I can ask the questions. I can do practice problems. I can make sure that I understand what I'm doing. I can go to YouTube and find other resources. So I think kids are actually able to advocate for themselves a lot better because they're not willing to just put up with only one modality.
Hey, given all the work that you've done over the past, gosh, I mean, it's close to 20 years at this point, Sal, I'm wondering, you know, how it changes the way you think about education with regard to your own kids.
Yeah, you know, even back in 2000, Khan Academy really got on folks' radar in 2009, 2010, 2011. I gave a TED talk where it's, you know, let's reimagine education, make things more personalized. We shouldn't have kids moving forward lockstep. If you only got a 70% on a test, you should always have that opportunity incentive to make that an 80%, make that a 90%. And I wrote a book, One World Schoolhouse, about how education could change, how you could even create a school of the future. And then in 2014, my oldest, I now have three kids, my oldest was just entering kindergarten age. And I said, hey, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I don't want to preach all of these things about mastery learning personalization and then not have my own kids do that. And not only that, but I actually did and continue to believe that that is the most powerful way to learn. So we started a school, Khan Lab School, where now all of my kids go. It's out here in Northern California. And what we're seeing is when you have a school that's really student-centered, where, you know, we have the one edict we have is there's no lectures at the school. Everything has to be active. Students can learn at their own time and pace. But once again, they're not in isolation. They get support from their peers. They get support from the faculty. When human beings are in the room together, they either have Socratic dialogue or they're doing projects or they're collaborating or they're tutoring each other. We have a motto, everyone's a student, everyone's a teacher. And we're seeing, we've had our first few graduating classes in the last couple of years, and I don't want to jinx it, but the kids are doing, frankly, better than you would expect from a traditional environment. We just looked at our lower school, which is, you know, grades K through 5, and our kids are seeing about 2 grade levels of math a year. We just launched a Khan World School with Arizona State University, which is an online high school, and they're using similar modalities, but in an online framework. And they just saw in the first semester 5 times the expected growth in math, and I think it was 3 times the expected growth in reading. And but once again, it's just because the kids are able to learn at their own pace. And because they're not learning to be passive and they're learning to have more agency over their learning, they're more entrepreneurial, they have more of a growth mindset, they're willing to take risks. We think they're feeling a lot less of the stress and anxiety that we know is a bit of an epidemic right now amongst young people.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So there's not a huge history with Conlab School because you only started it a few years ago. But where are you in terms of college placement and how you've been able to see how these kids have done longitudinally?
Yeah, as I said, the school's been around for about 8 years. We had this current graduating class is going to be our third. But you know, this is a school that does not have traditional letter grades. We measure, but at any point, students can improve their grade. But out of, you know, I remember our first graduating class of 9 students, they went to, and I'm very sensitive because so many folks index on where kids go to school and all of that. But our students ended up at some of the top places in the world. You know, I don't want to get too brand conscious about where they went, but they went to, let me just say, very, very good, very, very good places. And they're even more importantly, we stay in touch with these students and they're really thriving in these environments because frankly, the college environment is all about self-paced learning. The college doesn't pretend right. that way, but really that's what it's all about.
No, you're absolutely right. You get what you put into it essentially when you go to college. Hey, so Sal, we're looking at your school, Conlab School. Can you scale that? Do you want to scale it even further? It's in Mountain View, right? But can you go further with it or do you want to?
Yeah, the whole idea, and I always tell the team there that, is not just to start another school in Silicon Valley for my kids and other folks in this area. Obviously, you have to serve the kids and the community well, but it's really to show that there's another way of doing things and then essentially sharing with the world how to do that so it can scale. So one of the first ways of scaling is by starting Con World School with Arizona ASU. That's actually free to any student in Arizona because it has a state charter there. And then it's, we hope, reasonable cost outside, and we're working on more states. So you really can get a free world-class education if you're in the states that support something like this. So that's one scaling mechanism. And we are seeing folks form essentially hybrid pods where they're getting the benefits of in-person sports, et cetera, but then they're able to use the World School for their Socratic dialogue and their seminars and, you know, being able to meet their advisors and things like that. We also are starting more Conlab schools. It's likely we might start one in the Midwest. Mm. And so I think we are at the moment. I won't ever say we have nailed it. It's a lab school. We're constantly iterating, but I think we're starting to scale it, and that could take multiple forms. It could take an online school. It could be a share the curricula with other folks. However we can get it out there.
Sal, do the numbers work? It's really tough to be self-sufficient as a school. It's a private school, so there's, you know, tuition. But I mean, I went to a school that my friend's mom started for second grade, and the school was only around for about 10 years. They just couldn't keep it going. It was tough. Are the numbers working?
The numbers are working. And what I've always given the charter to the school that we should be able to be, in terms of cost per student per year, cost competitive with some public school districts. And there's huge variation. If you look at the high end, a New York City public school spends about $40,000 per student per year.
Wow.
A lot of, you know, Cambridge, Boston, Massachusetts, they are mid-20s, even approaching $30,000 per year. But then you have other places, including high cost of living places like California, where depending on the district, you're really looking at more of like $10,000 to $15,000 per year. Right now, if you were to hold all things equal, we actually have to pay a lot in real estate expense because we're renting out a couple of campuses. But if our real estate expense were similar to what a traditional public school was spending, we have our cost per student down to about $21,000 to $22,000 per year. And so if you include the real estate, then it's approaching a higher number. It's, you know, it's probably closer to $27,000 or $28,000. But to answer your question, we intentionally are keeping it much more accessible than the surrounding market would support. These numbers don't sound like small numbers to anyone anywhere, but if you live in the Bay Area, if you live in New York, you'll know that a lot of the top independent schools will easily charge you $50,000 or $60,000 a year. And you know, we're pretty focused on showing this model can scale and is accessible, and also has evidence that isn't just another independent school. It's the kids are growing faster and happier.
You know, in doing this, What's been the easy part? What's been the difficult part, Saul?
Of doing everything, including the school or Khan Academy or the whole...
Everything from the get-go. Like, I think about when you started, and I know, I remember, you know, we talked about Bill Gates being, you know, a supporter of it. You had some really high-profile people, and I'm sure that helped, you know, doing the TED Talk. But I'm just wondering, as you've done this, what's been the easy part? What's the difficult part?
Well, the easy part is this is something that I've always been drawn to, even when, you know, my past careers in tech, and I used to be an analyst at a hedge fund, both careers I enjoyed, but I always was drawn. That's why I started tutoring my cousins. That's why I started writing software for them. That was focused on learning. And that's why I started making videos, because I enjoyed making these education videos. So that was always the easy part. And whenever I want to recharge, even today, that's the kind of stuff that I try to really work on. Let me make some videos today. The hard part, I would say in the early days, the hard part is convincing people to take you seriously. Especially, you know, now it's a somewhat mainstream thing to be a YouTube influencer or whatever else. Back in 2006, 2007, 2008, it was very, let's call it, no one really took you seriously. And then once we started to get off the ground and people took note, I think when we said, no, we just don't want to be a YouTube channel. We don't want to be another for-profit education company. We actually want to create an institution for the world that actually has a chance of being the safety net education system for the world that can reach billions of people. I think back then, you know, some people might not take that so seriously for a guy operating out of a walk-in closet. I think you fast forward, and yes, you know, folks like Bill Gates and the Doers, and you know, there's so many people that, you know, I grew up reading about who have now become some of our supporters. But whenever I say those names, I remind folks that we still need their help. So please, folks, should donate to Khan Academy. But I think now what's gotten easier is when I take on a project, let's say we start a school, or we're starting this online high school, or we started another not-for-profit called Schoolhouse.World, which gives free tutoring. The way it's able to do is to leverage volunteership. These types of things would have been very hard when I was, you know, just a guy in a closet back in 2008 or 2009. But now people are willing to take it seriously. They're willing to partner. You know, the fact that even volunteers show up to Schoolhouse.World and to tutor other people is because there's some trust and belief in what we're trying to pull off. But even today, I think it's a lot of what I do is trying to get people to believe. I realize that that's like the believe both in our own organization, like, hey, folks, we're literally trying to move the dial for the world. And I know you can get cynical about that, but it's doable.
So I want to talk AI because, you know, we talked a little bit about BuzzFeed and it rising 74% today as a result of 85%, excuse me, as a result of a partnership that announced yesterday with OpenAI. C3.ai shares surging more than 17% today. How do you use AI in education?
Well, there's a lot of what we already know is going on, and then there's a lot of potential. Even before these large language models like, you know, ChatGPT and all of that, we've always thought, hey, AI could be used to, just as it's being used in for-profit companies to recommend the right ad to you, in an education setting, maybe it can be used to recommend the right content to you. And we've used variations of that in the past at Khan Academy. I think what's exciting about these large language models is the potential for them to start to act like a Socratic tutor, for them to introduce modalities that might not have existed before. I know people are really worried about this doing essays for students, but maybe we can embrace that and say, well, maybe it can help the student do something more ambitious. Maybe it can help give feedback that, you know, traditionally when you write an essay, at best, it might take you a week or two to get the feedback. And then even if you make it better, you may or may not get a chance to get feedback on that. Now you could get instant feedback. I did a little experiment with my daughter where we used a large language model to co-write a story, but then she had a chance to talk to one of the characters. That's something that just seems like science fiction, but it's now doable, or we're at the cusp of making these things doable. So if you imagine, I think we're in the next year, we're going to see layers on top of tools like Khan Academy where you might have a tutor, an AI tutor. Now, once again, I don't think this replaces the human, but it just gives more leverage to the human teacher, to the human parent, to be able to be able to do more.
It's like moving beyond when, you know, math, right? It used to be, what's the answer? Did you get the answer right? And then it moved to, wait, what was your thinking? And show us the work. And okay, you know, that was more important than really kind of the final, to some extent, or as important to getting the answer right. Hey, just quickly, one last thing. Just got about 40 seconds left here. What do you think about the ACTs and SATs? A lot of it went away during the pandemic. Good move. Like, do we have to move away from that stuff?
Well, no test is perfect, but I always tell people, if you don't like standardized tests, what part do you not like, the standardized or the test? And you need to have some way of understanding. And especially now that you have ChatGPT that can write your college essays, this is actually the fairest mechanism by which to be able to see who's college ready.
Brilliant. We have not. That is just an interesting way of thinking about this. And
I don't
really
like the test part, to answer your question.
Sal, thank you so much. Good luck. Such an incredible organization that you've created. And as we said, almost 20 years in, it's pretty remarkable. Sal Khan, he is founder and chief executive officer of Khan Academy, joining us via Zoom from Mountain View, California. Just Google them. You can find out all the incredible work that they are
doing. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Have been for a long time.
More than 50 languages.
Yep.
Used in more than 190 countries, 145 million registered users.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.